Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After each episode, you can connect with others in the sarcoma community on our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to delve deeper into the episode's topics. We hope you enjoy the episode and follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to receive updates on when our latest episodes become available. The podcast will also be on SFA's website, which is curesarcoma.org. You can find information on this particular subtype or your subtype on SFA's website. Links are in this episode's description. SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners. To amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients, SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link. On this episode, we speak with Brian Fuger, who is a synovial sarcoma survivor of 20 years. Brian shares his perspective on what the sarcoma landscape looked like 20 years ago at the time of his diagnosis, taking us through his treatment journey and how his marathon running has been an outlet for him to not only give back to the sarcoma community, but also reclaim his life. We are so fortunate to be able to be a part of Brian's reflection and discuss so many topics, like what to say to support someone during a sarcoma diagnosis, giving permission to be honest about how you're feeling, and the important roles of care partners in our life. Thank you so much, Brian, for sharing your sarcoma story. Let's dive in. Welcome back to Sarcoma Stories, or welcome to Sarcoma Stories if this is your first time listening. This is Tasha, one of your hosts.
And hi, I'm Brandy. I'm your other host.
Today, we are speaking with Brian Fuger. Brian, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm 67 years old. I'm a sarcoma survivor, a synovial sarcoma. I was diagnosed 20 years ago and am in full recovery, beyond full recovery, yeah.
That's amazing. We don't always get to talk to 20-year survivors in sarcoma, and especially on this podcast. So we're really excited to be able to have this conversation here with you today. Can you tell us how the sarcoma landscape has changed in 20 years? What was it like being diagnosed in 2005 with sarcoma? And what was that journey in terms of treatment options even like?
Yeah, well, it was lonely, I would say that. I mean, you know, there's been so much attention paid to so many other forms of cancer. And, you know, sarcoma is kind of a little bit of an island, you know, of neglect, quite honestly. The good and the bad is I'm a researcher and do a lot of research. That's the good news. And SFA was incredibly helpful because it was a repository of not only articles and research and findings, but also people who had gone through the experience. So that was very helpful. I mean, the downside of it is you get caught into a rabbit hole when you start doing the research. All of a sudden, everything fits your case. My case was pretty unique. I coughed up blood. I was incredibly healthy. Well, so to speak. Thought I was anyway. I had taken up running and I was a marathon runner. I ran the Boston Marathon in 2002 and I had just started to really push myself. I was 47 at the time and I was doing like all-time best. And I distinctly remember I was in Short Hills, New Jersey. I worked as a management consultant, so I was always traveling. I live in the Bay Area now, but I was in Short Hills, New Jersey on a treadmill at the Short Hills Marriott. And I had one of the best workouts of my life. I was like, wow, that was incredible. And then I went back to my room and I coughed up. I had felt something in the back of my throat and I coughed up blood. And I'm like, wow, what's that about? And so I was at the peak of what I thought was health. And yet at the same time, this silent assassin was inside me. So that's how the journey started. It was back in February of 2005. And I will say, I'll repeat, it was kind of a little bit lonely at the time.
Was that your only symptom, the coughing up blood?
Yeah, absolutely. I was feeling great, and it happened twice. It happened at the Short Hills, New Jersey, and then I was in bed on Valentine's Day with my wife, and I woke up about midnight and felt a lump on the back of my throat, and coughed up blood the second time. And of course, that started the research journey. I got up that evening, 1 o'clock in the morning, and started Googling coughing up blood, and none of it was good. But the range of severity was from something really minor, like a cyst, all the way through to something cancerous.
I can assume then that the first time you coughed up blood, you did not go to the doctor.
No. I was like, I just finished one of the best workouts of my life. How bad could this be? But the second time, and it had come within 10 days of the first, I was like, okay, something's going on here. I better look at it. But your question is a good one, because, and I think it gets to a point that is worth making, is, and men are a little worse at this than women, and it's like we tend to put things off. And coughing up blood is obviously not good, but I felt great. It would have been easy for me to ignore it again.
Well, like you said, what you were Googling in your symptoms or researching in your symptoms ranges from an array of severity.
Right. I mean, all the thing about the Googling was, it, if you cough up blood, it's like, well, first of all, my thing was very unique, because sarcomas almost never present in the lung. And that's usually a sign of advanced metastasis. And so that was not really a very likely possibility. I mean, there are other forms of cancer, or it would have been lung cancer or something else, but sarcoma was like the farthest possibility. In fact, Brandy, to your question, a presentation in the lung absent any other metastasis is incredibly rare.
What you had was the primary pulmonary synovial sarcoma. So for the listeners, that was what he was ultimately diagnosed with. So when you hear about presenting in the lungs and it's synovial sarcoma as the subtype, that is what he had. And I have a question about Google. When you Googled and you saw all these things, I would imagine sarcoma was not one of them.
No.
Right.
Like AV, I think it's AVRs, you know, the little blood sacs and cysts. And then you get into things more serious, like, you know, various types of other forms of cancer, including lung cancer. But no, sarcoma is not on the list.
So when you Googled that and you realized this is something that I need to really look into, this is maybe a much bigger deal, what'd you do? You'd call your primary care, or did you think I should go ahead and see a medical oncologist?
No, I primary care. And I went in, got me in the next day and did a chest x-ray and found a 3 or 5 centimeter mass on my lower left lung lobe. And he kind of said, I wouldn't worry too much about it. It's probably a cyst. He said, I want to get you into a pulmonologist to check. And so step one was the x-ray. Step two was a pulmonologist who did a endoscopic procedure and took a small sample. He said, again, he's like, well, probably, and I think it's an IV something. It's a small blood sac. I can't remember the name. It's probably that. Don't worry about it. But, you know, we'll take a sample and send it to pathology. And so that was step two. And then pathology came back and said, there's some troubling signs here, and we want to get you into a biopsy. But it was kind of like, this could be a lot of things, but don't worry, kind of thing. And then step three was a biopsy, and that came back after a few days with a diagnosis of synovial sarcoma. I'm going to get a little emotional here, but I remember the day like it was yesterday, and I went in to see my oncologist, and he basically said, you need to get your affairs in order, because you less than 6 months to live. And he said, it's in your lung. And so if it's sarcoma, it's metastasized to your lung and you probably have a primary source somewhere else. And so the cancer finds the glucose and it congregates there, and that's how we're able to find it. And she also said, depending on your diagnosis, which I said, okay, I can relate to that. So anyway, we did the PET scan and it came back with, there was no other indication anywhere else. And so it was like lung only, thankfully, because if it had metastasized to my lungs, things would have been, you know, a lot more dire. So that was, I guess, stage four. So it had gone through this successively worse, and which was really hard on my family. It's like all the way from it's a cyst to get your affairs in order. You have 6 months to live, kind of thing. And then what happens is, because the diagnosis kept changing, nobody believes anything anymore. You go to your family and you say, well, and they're like, well, whatever you're telling me, I'm going to think it's twice as worse as it is.
Right. Like, is it actually this? Because we said it was a cyst and it wasn't that. And then we said it was this other thing. And now you're telling me it's this. So is it actually this? Yeah. I feel like it creates mistrust in some way.
Well, you know, honestly, I think I think about it a little bit differently. The medical profession, they probably did it the right way. It's like, don't scare you if you don't have to. I think what I learned is that this was my first indication that this was going to be a roller coaster, and expect the unexpected, because the unexpected just kept happening. And I think getting yourself prepared for the fact that it's going to be a roller coaster and there are going to be ups and downs is really valuable. Because if I had started with that kind of frame, it would have been helpful for me, I think. But I think they did it right. I think don't give worst case out of the gate.
Yeah. So when you heard that it was a sarcoma and they said to get your affairs in order, how long was it between then and the PET scan before you realized, okay, it's not good, but it might not be that bad?
Well, it's a funny story. It's 2 to 3 weeks, but I had, because I had published that a book just a couple weeks earlier, I had an interview on CNN and to interview me about the book. And this was after the Get Your Affairs in Order diagnosis and before the PET scan, which said it was localized. And I was in San Francisco on California Street. I remember the CNN studio. And I got there early. And I went to Starbucks and I said, screw it. I'm just having like a big old giant apple fritter. I'm on my last few weeks of life. It's like, or last few months of life. I don't care anymore. That's interesting. I wish I had journaled that 2 weeks, because my God, there are so many. I just remember I had so many interesting thoughts in the 2 weeks, almost none of which I can remember.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's too bad. It would have been great to journal that kind of roller coaster of.
I know. It would have been priceless. I know.
It's interesting, though, because, you know, that's hard to remember. It's a whirlwind, as anyone can imagine. But the way you recalled the doctor telling you you have 6 months to live is still so raw with emotion.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in your perspective on that. You know, 20 years has gone by and that moment is still so crystal clear.
Yeah.
How we talk about.
It's an interesting question. The brain does funny things. I mean,
yeah.
It sears and cements certain memories and other stuff it chooses to forget. And if I could explain it, I'm probably being a different job.
Yeah, totally. We hear a lot from survivors that once you have a cancer diagnosis, even when you finish treatment, like it doesn't end because you enter this next phase of survivorship or whatever it may be. But do you feel like it ends at some point with 20 years of knowledge about this? Or do you feel like,
yeah,
how does that journey progress?
That's an interesting question. So what happened was sarcoma, synovial sarcoma, sarcomas in general have high recurrence rates. That's one of the things that everyone struggles with. So then I was on a 3-month scan schedule after I had, well, we can talk about my treatment regimen. I had surgery, then chemo. But after I finished treatment, I was on a 3-month schedule, and there was not an hour in the first 3 months. There was not an hour in a day that went by that I didn't think about it. And in particular, if I had a sniffle or a cough or an ache or I felt tired, it was like, oh, it's back, you know, kind of thing. Because I knew that if I had a recurrence, my doctors pretty much told me that your odds are not good. So every little tiny thing. So that was the first 3 months. Second 3 months, I could go a few hours and not think about it. And 2 weeks before the scan, my anxiety level was through the roof. And you have the scan, and then you're waiting for the results. And if it goes one way, it's goodbye. If it goes the other way, another 3 months. So then the third 3 months, you could almost create a chart. Third 3 months, not so bad. But I'd go a few days, not think about it. I'd get some anxiety a few days before the scan. And then fourth 3 months, things really started to fade. And then after 4 checkups, my oncologist changed the schedule to every 6 months. And it just sort of gradually faded away. Little anxiety spikes around a scan. So then I had 2 more scans. And third year, I didn't think about it much at all. I had a couple more scans. And then fourth year, he changed it to an annual. So I had my 4-year scan. And I hadn't, by that point, I wasn't thinking about it anymore. You know? I really wasn't worried. And fourth year, he said, I've never seen a recurrence of this particular cancer after 4 years. And the risks of radiation outweigh the diagnostic benefits of a scan. So you're done. And now 20 years on, I just don't even think about it. Other than seeing somebody else suffering through it. And I have zero worries. Zero.
That was one of my questions of how does it impact your life now, all these years later, and does it at all?
It's been a blessing because, you know, in the bizarre way that tragedies can become blessings, I was able to learn a lot of things about myself and about relationships and adversity, and that I genuinely believe have made me stronger today. You know, so it's as tough as it was, it's a blessing, quite honestly. Not that I would want to go through it again.
We'd love to have those lessons in a less life-threatening way, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, right. I want to circle back to kind of talk a little bit more about your journey. Because on one hand, I'm listening to some of the things you're saying, and I'm thinking, here we are 20 years later, and it's so very similar for people who are diagnosed today. But I'd like to hear, after you got the diagnosis and they said, okay, it's localized, and you have this huge sigh of relief that maybe I don't have to get my affairs in order right now. What did they say? What were your options then?
Well, so there are 2 primary modalities, surgery and chemo. And I will say this, not to be pejorative, but surgeons cut and chemists do chemistry, and never the two shall meet. And so I was consulting a surgeon who was like, out, let's get it out, because I had a tumor. And then the oncologist was like, well, there's different options for us here. After you learn that surgeons cut and chemists do chemistry, it kind of helps you think about the right treatment modality. The general consensus was to do surgery first. So I had a lobectomy, which is, a lot of people don't know this, but you actually have 5 lung lobes. It's one of the few uneven things in your body. 3 on the left, 2 on the right. I had my lower left lung lobe taken out, which is it's I would say common, but pretty invasive. I had that done. And the good news about that is every day you're a little better. And that's a beautiful thing. It's like, okay, today I can do something I couldn't do yesterday. And then the next day I could walk a little farther. And So I had the surgery, and then they give you time to recover and recuperate before they start the chemo assault, which is a whole different thing. So I had a good 8 to 10 weeks before I started chemo.
How long were you on the chemotherapy?
So I had exactly Lance Armstrong's regimen, by the way, which is, for those who are familiar, it's ifosfamide, adriamycin, and Mensis or something to help the stomach. Particularly challenging regimen. It was done on an inpatient basis. So I was in for a week. And then the way I like to put it is they let me out for 3 weeks so they could kick my ass again. I had 4 treatments. And then in the middle, I got pneumonia. And I was put in isolation for, I don't know, another week. But the chemo, I was like, bring it on. And I had the adriamycin is a particularly evil chemo. It's red and everything turns red. It's like, and this smell is just, it's just awful. But anyway, I went through my first week and inpatient, had to suffer through horrible hospital food. But I was kind of like, is this all you got? Like, come on, this is not hard. So I had the first week and it was not hard. And then I was a little cocky. And then the second week, my cockiness started to dissipate. And it was like, oh, this is really unpleasant. This is getting hard. Everything tasted metallic. And well, I had lost all my hair by this point. So, and I'll do a couple side journeys here. It's the little things sometimes that they don't tell you that are the most debilitating. So, for example, when you lose all your hair, you lose your nose hairs and your eyelashes. And you don't realize that your nose hairs prevent dust from entering and irritants. And so I had a runny nose 24/7, like literally 24/7, my nose ran and my eyes watered 24/7. I was like, this wasn't in the literature.
Yeah, right. I didn't hear about this side effect.
I had a few things like that. My fingernails started, the rings around a tree trunk. I started getting like tree trunk rings on my fingernails and they became very brittle. I'm like, that wasn't in the literature either. So there's all these little things that they don't warn you about. But the second round, it beat me up pretty good. But I was like, okay, if this is as bad as it gets, I can deal with this. It's very, very unpleasant, but I can deal with it. Third round, it was bad. It was really bad. I felt like I was in a hole that I couldn't climb out of. And there was just no getting out of that hole. And it's just like, oh my God, like this is, I couldn't eat. Everything tasted, had a metallic taste to it. I got a blood clot. And so my arm swelled up to like, had an elephant arm. It was like double the size. And a friend came in and he's like, God, you look like shit.
Thank you. An honest friend.
Yeah, thank you very much. Actually, it was good though. It was actually good.
Better than being like, you look great.
And I remember I got out of the third week and I had made a habit of trying to go for a walk every day. And I went for a walk and I ran into a neighbor who didn't know what I was going through. And she said, how you doing? You know, just as, you know, you run into people casually. Hey, how things going? I was like, you know what? I really feel like shit. Things are not going well at all for me. And I unloaded for about 10 minutes. And I'm thinking, and the look on her face, I can see it today. It's like, oh my God. So that was round 3. And then I got pneumonia. I started getting a temperature and they had to put me in isolation. I went back for another week and they delayed round 4. And then I got round 4 and I was just like, whatever, this fucking thing over with, please. You know, it was just really bad. And I was so beat up. I lost 30 pounds and I'm not a big guy to start with. So I lost a ton of weight. I was bald. I was lily white. But that's when the rebirth started was I'd come across Lance Armstrong's book. It's Not About the Bike, I think was the title. And he was, say what you want about Lance Armstrong. He's not the perfect person. But he waged a valiant battle against.
Yes.
We owe him a lot of respect for that. Mm-hmm. He said, just keep moving. Because you going through chemo and you're in the hospital, it's like you just sit there. And he said, just keep moving, among other things. But I took that away from the book and I'm like, okay, that feels like good advice. And so I got up and I started doing rounds around the ward. And I have a weird thing with numbers. I do math around everything. So calculated the number of steps around the ward and said, okay, if I did this many laps, it would be a marathon, be 26.2 miles, and I can do this. I can do it. So I got a friend of mine and asked her for some help, and we put together what we called the Box of Chocolates Marathon, and to raise money for SFA. And a box of chocolates is, the reference is, with a box of chocolates, you never know what you're going to get, which I thought was a interesting metaphor for my cancer. You never know what you're going to get. So we organized a marathon around the, in the hospital. I was carrying my IV pole because I was 24/7 drip. And we did 144 laps around the ward. It took 3 days and 7 hours, 7.5 hours, but we did it and it was great. I was kind of at the very bottom and this gave me a purpose and something to do. And we raised, I think it was, I went back, looked at my notes, we raised $42,000 for—
That's amazing.
An incredible amount of
That's
money.
Amazing. Was it just you and your friend, or you did it all by yourself, or did other people in the hospital join you because they needed to walk too?
I was on the cancer floor and my family, my wife, my kids, my friend, but other cancer patients joined me for laps. And I think it lifted the hospital floor, the oncology wing. So yeah, because I think people, it's sense of hope, and I don't have to be stuck in my bed just taking all this that they're giving me. I can have agency and do things on my own and take command and control and push myself to do things. And so that turned out to be a good thing.
Yeah. And I bet those people who joined in remember it to this day, right? It's something they'll never forget because they, like you said, it gave them something to look forward to too. It also kind of taught them the same thing it taught you, is I can still do this. I can still do these things. I have something to look forward to, and my body can still do these things. So what an amazing thing to think of to do, not just for yourself, but to bring along others with you.
Yeah, you'd have to ask them, but I hope that they carry that memory with them. It was, you can do this. You can do it. And the reservoirs you tap, and this is one of the things that's lived with me to this day, is that when you're in a state of adversity, the reservoir of courage that is available to tap into is deep. You just have to tap into it, though. I think I have to add a corollary to that. It's like, not everyone has to do that. And it's okay to feel bad. It's okay to feel crummy. And it's because the one thing that, when you go through this, a lot of people are like, oh, if you have a good attitude, you'll get through it. I want to give people permission to have a bad attitude, because you will, and it's okay. You know, that people, a lot of people don't know what to say to you when you go through treatment, and you have to kind of give them forgiveness for that, because I wouldn't know what to say. I know now, but I wouldn't know what to say to somebody. But one of the things that naturally comes out of most people's mouths is, you keep a good attitude about this and you'll be fine, you know, kind of thing. And that turned out to be the worst thing that you could possibly say, because it's okay to feel shitty. It's okay. It really is. Not permanently, but you're going through a lot.
We've heard that from other folks on this podcast, but also one of the things that has come up, not just on this podcast, but in our discussions with other folks who've been impacted, is the whole idea of strong, right? And the pressure that it puts on people to be strong all the time. When in fact, as you told your neighbor, I'm not feeling so good. You want to know how I feel? I'm going to tell you how I feel.
Right.
And it was that moment that you needed to let that out. I'm curious, when you were going through it as well, you mentioned your wife and kids. How old were your kids at this time? And how did you deal with that thinking, especially from the moment of, you have 6 months to live, and going through this journey and them seeing you sick? What was that like for your family?
Yeah, so the kids were, 20, 18, 16, 13. And two were in college. And then two in high school. Yeah. And it's just rough. They were totally there for me, but a certain part of them didn't want to face it. Just too hard. I remember they came, I was in the hospital after surgery, and they came and I was on a morphine drip, incoherent, 90% incoherent, and catheter, literally drooling. And I remember my wife and the kids came and it was bad. I mean, they were like, this isn't my dad. This isn't my husband. And so on the one hand, you want to see them all the time. On the other hand, you kind of want to protect them from seeing the worst kind of thing. So it's a tough thing to balance. It erodes trust when you have to help them process the difficult news. I remember the most difficult thing was going through the diagnosis, and it kept getting worse. Then having to face the kids who then like, well, you just told us this. Now you're telling us this, and now you're telling us this kind of thing. That's hard.
Right. And feeling like maybe, are you being honest?
Right. Right. I would opt toward transparency. I had to do it 100 times again. I'd opt for transparency. And different ages can process different things. So you have to be
Was there any resource that helped you kind of arrive at the decision to be transparent, or if there was any that you would recommend to another parent who's maybe going through this now or not?
I did a lot of reading. I can't recall particular sources and citations and things like that, but we did a lot of reading. Just talking to other people who've gone through it is really, really helpful, because then you can gauge what their experience was. And then I did after treatment. Had a kind of an interesting story. I joined a survivor support group. And I remember for the first meeting, I was particularly, because I was a runner. I was like, this is really cruel that this would affect my lungs. Awful. I'm angry about that kind of thing. And I'm blabbering on about my lungs. And I was totally oblivious because three seats next to me was a woman who had lost her leg. And it was one of those moments that you really recall after I looked over and I said, oh my God, I'm talking about my lungs not having 80% lung capacity instead of 100%. And this woman lost her leg. And like, what am I saying? What am I thinking? And it actually was a gigantic realization for me that everybody's carrying a cross. So that was a really, really important realization for me, getting out of my own pity and seeing the world from a broader lens. It was a big deal. It helped me think about things very differently.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about your running as well, because as you said, you were a runner and you were at the peak of your running when you got diagnosed. And now you have lost part of your lung and you don't have the same lung capacity. But how did you get back into running? And how did that play a role in your, maybe in a therapeutic way, moving forward?
Well, it was a huge deal. So I finished chemo. I had my surgery in March, and then I finished chemo in September. This was chemo had really, really kicked my butt. But then once they stopped choosing to kick my butt, I was able to start getting better. So I started getting a little bit better, and I said, I'm gonna try running again. First time out, like a block, you know. Second time out, a block and a half, you know. Third time out, you know, a block and three quarters. But then I started to get my strength back, and one of the big decisions that I made was I picked a race. So I started running in November, and I picked a race in March. That was my goal. And it was a 5K race. But it really was motivating to me. And I got out there and I got back and I competed really well. And it was kind of like, okay, I'm back. And so that was huge. And then I did a very foolish thing. I was out to lunch with a friend, and I had run a marathon in 2002. So 4 years earlier, I'd run a marathon, and he had run a marathon. And we said, these ultra marathons and things over 26 miles are kind of interesting. And, you know, as you know, men sometimes do, we challenged each other, you know, to, okay, let's do an ultra together. So we signed up for a 50 mile race in Sacramento. This was actually a couple years later. So this was 2009. So I'd continued running, but in late 2008, we signed up for a 50-mile race. We used it as another fundraising opportunity. We called it the running of the fools, as opposed to the running of the bulls, running of the fools. And it was, I would say, forgive my language, it was my fuck you to cancer. You know, you're gonna invade my lung. I'm gonna come back and run a 50-mile race, which is kind of the ultimate test of endurance and using your lungs. I'm going to get back. And so we ran that race, and that raised $32,000, I think. And people were glad to contribute. It's like, because it was inspirational for a lot of people that, because I ran as the over 50 missing one lung lobe division. I said, I'm competing in the over 50 missing one lung lobe division, which I won, by the way. a group of one. So that was a big deal, because there's nothing I can't do then. That was like, cancer, you're gone and I'm back and screw you. And so it taught me that I could do things that I never thought I could do. 50 miles is kind of a long way. And so, but then, because that's not enough, the next year, we upped it. My friend and I went to lunch again. I never go to lunch with him anymore.
No, he's got to be off the list.
And we challenged each other to a 100-mile race, which is totally ridiculous. But so Vermont has an ultramarathon. It's in the summer. It's in the mountains in Vermont. And it's a 100-mile race, 15,000 feet of elevation and 15 ascent and 15,000 feet of elevation decline. It was 93 degrees that day.
The worst condition.
There were 350 starters, and I'm proud to say I was one of 153 finishers.
Wow.
In 23 hours and 45 minutes. You run through the night. You start at 3 a.m., the gun goes off at 3 a.m. and you, 4 a.m. You start at 4 a.m. You run through the night, and I finished at 3:45 a.m. the next day. Dumbest
thing. Did you get breaks?
If you're an elite runner, which I'm not, you kind of run the whole thing. If you're not an elite runner, you run on flat and downhill, and uphill you walk. And then you, every 3 miles, there's, you know, potato chips and M&Ms and...
And a chair.
Peanut butter sandwiches. And chair.
I can sit down for a minute.
Those little goo packets that are
the gels.
I had 27 of them.
Oh my God. Wow. Did you ever sit down and think, I'm not getting back up?
Well, it's actually a very conscious strategy. If you have to be very careful, because if you do sit down for too long, you won't get up. It's one of the things that's interesting is you had the option of getting a buddy assigned to you who runs the last 10 miles with you. And you don't know who it is. It's somebody who volunteers to do that. And I said, yes. And oh my God, thank God, because I wouldn't have made it without him. He kept me going, which is another interesting metaphor that I feel compelled to talk about with the whole cancer journey. Man, oh man, having an advocate and someone who's there in your court, and particularly navigating the healthcare system, it's like there's lots of wonderful things and wonderful practitioners and miracles that occur, but you are a number. You have to advocate for yourself. And a lot of times, I have a lot of business experience and negotiating experience, but when it came to my self-care, I wasn't up for it. I was like, whatever, I trust you, whatever. And I had a friend who pushed hard, who asked tough questions and questioned everything and forced things to happen when they weren't happening. So not everyone has the luxury of having an advocate, but if you can have one and find one, and man, oh man, it's helpful. It's so helpful. Trying to do this on your own, ooh, man, you know, plus my wife and kids, you know. So I had a team in my court, and man, that made all the difference.
Yeah, I was about to ask you if you had drawn any parallels between running and treatment. And I think, you know, like you said, having that person, whoever they may be, a friend, family member, a foundation. Like, that is part of why we do what we do here, is to be that person when people need that advice and that help and that encouragement. Yeah.
It can come from so many different sources. There's no formula. It's different for everyone. It can be a spouse. It can be children. It can be a friend. It can be just somebody at SFA, you know? It can be anybody. But boy, don't be afraid to ask for help, because you'll need it.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that.
Yeah. Really good advice.
Huge.
Yeah. And I do like the analogy of the person who just jumps in for that last 10 miles, right? Just to get you over the edge. I'm just here for you to be that support. You don't even have to know me, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's one thing that, as you said at the very beginning, it's very lonely. And we continue to hear how lonely it is. But one thing I want people to know is that there are people out here cheering them on, or who would step in for those last 10 miles, or whatever it is you need to provide support. They're out there. And if you just ask for it, they will absolutely stand up for you.
I think the point that you just made is, don't be afraid to ask for it. People have an incredible reservoir of goodwill to help, and sometimes they don't know how to help, and sometimes we feel reluctant to ask for it. You know, we don't want to bother you, you know, or we just want to crawl into our own little hole, you know. And it's like, no. You can crawl into your own little hole, but don't forget to ask for help.
It's a courageous act sometimes to ask for help, but so worth it on the other side. And I want to ask you about that, because 2009 was the year you trained for Running for the Fools and ran that. It was also the year that you were the recipient of our Courage Award at our Stand Up to Sarcoma Gala. And I'm wondering if you could share what courage means to you. I think there's a classic definition as the recipient of that award. How would you define courage?
Ooh, that's a tough question. Let me think for a second. I know the word that just jumped into my head for whatever reason is resilience. The ability to, when things are thrown your way, is to be resilient and survive. And I think that's courageous. Because, I mean, it's easy. In fact, the path of least resistance is to be not resilient. I say this non-judgmentally and genuinely so. It's easy to get into a victim frame, because no one asked for this. You know, make all the right decisions in your life. You do things the way you're supposed to, and you play by the rules, and this happens to you. I mean, that's the definition of being a victim, right? And so you are a victim by definition, but that's different than falling into victimhood, if that makes sense. And so I think courage is the resilience to avoid that, I think.
Mm.
That's what comes to mind. I'll probably dream about it tonight and think of another definition.
I put you on the spot with that one.
That's a good question.
You mentioned asking for help. And one thing that I wanted to comment on is, don't be afraid. Do you think people are afraid? And I agree with you. We've heard this time and again, people hate to ask for help, just in normal things, but especially in a situation like this. But also I wonder, is asking for help, we talked earlier about being strong, and you've got this. I mean, how many times do people say this? You know, you've got this.
Right.
You're so strong. Look how strong he is. Or they wear the t-shirts, such and such strong.
Yeah.
Which I understand is a motivating factor. You need something to hang on to. But from the perspective of someone who's living through it, does it make it harder to ask for help because it shows weakness?
No, it doesn't.
But in your mind, it's like, everybody thinks I'm strong. I got this. I can handle it. I can do it. But if I ask for help, maybe people will think I can't.
Wait,
maybe
that's a great question. I think it's I'll admit it's unfair, but I grew to hate that whole be strong. So I wanted the strength to come from me, not from a slogan on a shirt or from someone's perception. I really dislike that. And it did make it harder. It actually, which is part of why I say to people, it's really okay to not be strong and be vulnerable. And you don't have to put up this false front all the time. Ultimately, you have to come to a frame of strength and courage. I think that's, if you can get there, it's great. But don't feel like you've got to put on this front all the time with people. I really grew to dislike that whole thing. Oh, it's like, be strong. It's like, fuck you. You don't realize I just pissed a bunch of red Adriamycin that smelled like horrible. And, you know, you want to be here for that and tell me to be strong. I'm not going to be strong about that because it was horrible.
Yeah.
But when you back up and zoom out, there's ways to be strong, you know, big picture, but there's so many in the moment. What's the word I'm looking for? Humiliations and things that you're put through that you just like, they're horrible.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like the strength that needs to be acknowledged is the strength in just getting up the next day and continuing to move through it. Being strong isn't like, yes, I'm going to do this with a positive attitude. Being strong is, I feel awful. This is humiliating what I've been through, and I'm going to get up tomorrow and do it all again in the hopes that I keep living.
Because I don't have a choice.
Right. I think there's a little bit of a corollary too in how you face people. So I think it's helpful to adopt a frame of forgiveness for people for a couple of reasons. One is a lot of people really don't know how to react. They're very uncomfortable. They come into, you know, you have a diagnosis of cancer, and they 99% of the population is gracious and respectful and are truly looking to help. I mean, you just start with, that's the beauty of humanity. But in the moment, I got a lot of really awkward and weird, and some people just don't show up. I mean, if I had to give two pieces of advice, one is forgiveness on the receiving end, but on the giving end, I would say just show up. That's it. That's it. That's all you have to do. That's all you have to do is show up. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what you give. I mean, I don't want any more flowers, quite honestly, but the most meaningful gift I got was someone gave me a running shirt. That was beautiful. It was better than the cookies and the flowers and the balloons. Not that people don't know what to do. Just show up. Just show up. Just show up. But on the receiving end, practice gratitude and forgiveness. Practice forgiveness, because people will say stupid stuff, or they won't say the right thing, or they won't show up, and it's okay. It just means that this is really uncomfortable for people to deal with. It's hard. And to be honest, you're in your own little world. I mean, one of the things that I think by definition, but it's useful to remind yourself, I became pretty self-absorbed, you know, very self-absorbed. And of course, I mean, like, you're in survival mode and you kind of have to be. But if there's a little piece in your little thing in your brain that clicks on and says, hey, all these other people are bearing their crosses and have their life to live, are worried about, I'm getting a spam call.
Just kidding.
And they're worried about getting the kids to soccer practice, and their sick parents at home, and they have all sorts of things that people are worrying about, you know, and you just have to realize that. So keep that in your head. It's okay to be self-absorbed, but it's good to know you're being self-absorbed. It's not okay to be self-absorbed and not know you're being self-absorbed.
It does. I want to ask you about, you mentioned earlier that you had written a book, and your book had just been published, right? I guess it was after you were diagnosed. Same month. And how did that impact the book? Meaning, from my understanding, book tours, going to book signings, book promotion. How did that and also, did you continue working throughout all this? How did this impact all of that, your career? A new book being published. What was the impact?
So the book is called Why Business People Speak Like Idiots. It's on Amazon. I can't help, 20 years later. And by the way, a side note is it's been 20 years since that book was published. I just got my first royalty check for like $3. So, which was actually the greatest thing that ever happened to me, is like to get paid for something you did 20 years ago. It blew my mind. It's not a very good book, quite honestly, but it's a book and it got published, which is a big deal. I had two co-authors, and so they were able to pick up the slack on the promotion side of it. It was a little disheartening to know that, you know, you want to get out there and push it, and I'm the primary author on it, and I was pretty much not able to do that. So that hurt a little bit, but whatever, you know, kind of thing. Work-wise, I've the amazing employer, an amazing boss. I'm so fortunate, and I count my blessings. They said to me, just look, get better, come back to work when you're ready. And I got paid the whole time. And it was beautiful. I worked for Deloitte, and my boss, a guy by the name Barry Salzberg, he was amazing. Just like, get better. That's it. Get better. So I took off about 6 months and then went back to work and kind of got right back into it with, and I think, again, to go back to where we started, a blessing in terms of being able to not get so caught up in the daily stuff, crap that goes on that stresses people out. I was able to zoom out a little bit and say, you may be worried about missing a deadline or something, but let me tell you, a lot of people going through a lot more difficult things than this. So let's not get too stressed out about this. I was able to bring, I would say, greater perspective to work. And it was really helpful. It was really helpful. And so in the end, it didn't impact. But again, I was blessed with, really, really blessed with a generous and understanding employer and boss. It was great.
When my mom was going through it, and I was, you know, her caregiver, I remember I had just started a new job, actually. And I remember my boss at the time saying the same thing. Take as much time as you need. We're going to go ahead and pay you. And you just get through this and come out the other side and we'll be here. And I have to admit, that has impacted me. Here I am, what, almost 15 years later. And that has stayed with me more than anything. The grace that he gave in that moment is something that I try to pay forward all the time. I resonate with what you just said so much. I mean, I understand the sense of relief that you feel. And I wasn't going through near what you were going through, but it's that sense of relief, that one less thing you didn't have to worry about, right? Or that stress and pressure.
And it's a big thing.
Yeah.
I think you, Brandy, you also mentioned the caregiver, and we haven't talked about that. Caregiving's hard. I have an interesting metaphor. It's like, I ran the, in an ultra marathon race, you often have a crew that crews for you and goes to different rest stops and carries a change of shoes and some extra food and takes care of you at these rest stops, and which was wonderful. But then I volunteered to crew for a friend who did a 100-mile race, and it was harder than hell. It was like I had no idea. I was 24 hours, you know, going to all these different stops and waiting in the cold. It was really hard. Anyway, as a metaphor for caregiving, it's hard. I don't think we as patients can so easily recognize how difficult it is. Again, this gets into that place of being, we're in our little justifiably self-absorbed world, but the caregivers are going through a lot of anguish and a lot of grief. My wife went through hell, and it's really, really hard. And I think, again, forgiveness and grace and generosity toward our caregivers is a very big deal. I really strongly encourage people to have that frame as they think about the people that are helping them. It's hard. It's really hard. And I didn't realize it.
Yeah. Absolutely. There's the idea that caregivers don't get enough credit. And what you said just resonated, because from my perspective as the patient, it's what I'm 3 years out. And that is probably what I think, not most about, but something that hits me more now than it did at the time of diagnosis, is just how much they all did and just how hard it was for them. Because at the time, all I could think about was, it's my body going through this and how I feel matters. But I had no idea. I knew I couldn't conceptualize it until my life was no longer at risk. You know,
that's a great way to put it. And they're going through this thing where they're trying to be strong for you.
Right.
It's almost like you need to give them permission. If you're asking for permission to be weak, you need to give your caregivers permission to be vulnerable.
Yeah. And I almost wonder if the giving the credit sometimes from the patient perspective, I always say, oh, we don't give caregivers enough credit. And I'm like, gosh, I should give my caregivers more credit. Like, yeah. From me, it might be more meaningful than society if I were to say to them, I give you a lot more credit.
I agree 100%. And I think that's really, really good advice. It's like just saying to a caregiver, I know how hard this is for you. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And by the way, I don't expect perfection.
Yeah, that's so true.
I mean, it just saying that to a caregiver would go an enormous distance, I think. They just understand that you understand, what kind of thing.
I think that makes a good point, because I will say after my mom passed, I had tremendous amount of guilt of feeling like, and the moment in my life where I needed to be the strongest, I wasn't, right? I wasn't strong enough for her. All these things that I should have done, I could have done, I didn't know this, I didn't do that. I struggled with that, quite frankly. And you are so just giving the permission to, because you do feel like you have to be strong all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're watching someone, you feel the weight of it of, I have to keep all this together because look what they're going through. And then you feel very guilty for feeling stressed about it or feeling any, like it's overwhelming. Because then you look at the person you love and it's like, as you said, it's not as bad as how they have it. So I shouldn't be feeling this way. But then you're also watching someone you love go through something that you cannot fix. You cannot make better for them. And see, now I'm going to get emotional. That you can't make better for them. That you can't take away their pain. And you want to rise to the challenge and do the best that you can do. And then when that doesn't happen, the weight that you feel because of that. So I appreciate you saying that, Brian, because that absolutely resonates with me of just getting that permission, because it took me a long time. And I don't know that I'm to this day, all these years later, and I've lost my father since then as well to cancer. And I don't know to this day that I've let go of that feeling of I failed. I wasn't strong enough for them.
And the guilt, I think people and society fires to make that guilt worse. And it's misplaced. I mean, it really is. It's undeserved. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. On the mention of guilt, Brian, can I ask how and if you've felt survivor's guilt throughout 20 years, do you experience it? And how, with 20 years of experience, do you handle that?
I genuinely don't think. I think I've, again, the brain works in interesting ways. I think I've kind of repressed, like, for example, this conversation is the first time I've talked about cancer in 2-3 years. I genuinely don't think about it. And I think I just kind of force myself to put it behind, or my brain subconsciously, I don't think I even consciously tried to do that. It just kind of happened. And so I don't, when you run across stories and things, you do feel bad, but I can't say that I feel survivor's guilt. Yeah.
And I think that's valid. That's why I asked if, because
I don't feel guilty. Feeling guilty.
No. And I think that's, it's valid, but it's complex and it's adaptive, right? Over 20 years, I imagine the way you feel about your diagnosis changes. It's honestly hopeful to hear.
Yeah, I think, Natasha, your point raises another point, I think, which is everyone takes their own journey. There's no two journeys. No two journeys are the same. And
right,
we all need to respect everyone's individual journey. We can all offer our own journeys as something to reflect on, but everyone's got their own, you know, and there's no right journey, you know.
Exactly. That's such a good way to phrase it. Yeah. Well, and that's what I get from every one of our guests, right? We have all of these amazing conversations and every single guest is different. Every person has a different experience. And I think that's the beauty in listening to every single person's experience is it's all different.
You guys have a wealth of learning. I mean, going through, how many of these have you been through?
This is we have, I think it's 14. If there's 14 that will be recorded, I don't know what it was at the time of your release, but.
You guys should write a
book or a journal. You've been very genuine. There are themes that are emerging.
Yeah.
I can tell just from your reaction to some of what we talked about. So it's like, yeah, we've heard that before. And you've been able to go one step further, not only recognize the theme, but be able to put meaning behind it, which is like, I would love to see if it was a short little monograph on, you know, learnings from, or a survivor, whatever it is, whatever the title is. But after you go through 20 of these, I want you to think about that. That would be incredibly helpful, because there are 5 things we've learned.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's been interesting because we talk and after we record these, we go back to the staff and give them an update on what we've recorded. And every single time we start with, this was so different. And we go into this with sort of an idea of things that we want to talk about. Yeah, but the conversation just goes where it goes, right? We just let it flow to where that person's journey takes us. But there are certain themes that as we do this more and more that definitely resonate with us, because I don't know if you've noticed, but I've taken a lot of notes throughout as you've said things. And there are themes that continue to resonate that intuitively, but to hear people say it and also say it in different ways, right? They say it in different ways, but it's the same impact.
You could do an audio book of short of excerpts. Like, what are the most salient, meaningful, provocative excerpts from all these interviews? That'd be amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting you said write a book, because I was going to ask you, one of the things you said earlier in our discussion is how many things that you learned from going through this about yourself as a person. And I wondered if you thought writing a book, because I already have a title for you.
Yeah.
And my title is One Block at a Time. And because you said to us in this discussion, when you started running again, it was one block. Then it was a block and a half.
Yeah.
And then it was two blocks. And it's sort of a metaphor, right? It's sort of the metaphor for how you get through it. How you get through a sarcoma journey is literally one block.
So I think a lot of survivors have this idea of let me write a book, capture what I've learned and what I've experienced. So there's a lot of stuff on the market. Seriously thought about it, but then I decided it's just not something I want to do. I don't want to, first of all, I didn't think I could offer that much. I was like, people, as much as it's interesting to me, it is a pretty small subset of people that it's interesting to, which is why I find it interesting, the idea of a tight audio book, because to me, something gets missed in the written word that comes out in the spoken word. I mean, for obvious reasons, I mean, sometimes writing, you're able to expound on something in a much more profound way because you have the benefit of time and the beauty of language and the profundity of that. But in this example, it feels to me like hearing the words spoken is more powerful, I think. And so that's why I'm interested in you guys doing that. Like taking these interviews and splicing together something wouldn't be easy, but it would be really useful. Podcast.
That's a good idea.
It is.
That's a really good idea.
But I mean,
audiobook.
Yeah.
Put it all together.
Think about it. Yeah.
Hearing from the survivors.
I'll write the foreword.
Yeah, it's going to be a collaborative effort. Yeah. I will say, though, every single time I share episode on my LinkedIn, I always start with, like, I'm so grateful to this person. And it's so true, though, because this podcast wouldn't happen unless people were open to being this vulnerable and sharing their stories. And in many cases, revisiting a time in their life that is painful. But the sharing, even though all of our experiences are uniquely different, I've heard the quote, what's personal is universal. And there's so much learning from it.
Oh, that's a great quote.
And I do really feel so privileged. Anyone could host this podcast. And I do feel very privileged to be sitting here as a host and be able to hold space for these stories and learn from them. Because I do think Brandy and I walk away. I won't speak for Brandy, but I think we do walk away every single time afterwards saying, wow, I really reflected on this and I learned.
It's been profound. I mean, I say this all the time, especially being the CEO, right? There's a lot of things that I know and a lot of things I have to know. But then we record one of these and I think there's so much I don't know. There's so much I don't know. There's so much that SFA needs to do. You know, that's kind of the feeling I get is, and we walk away from these a lot saying, okay, we need to do that, or we need to think about this, or we need to figure out how to make that happen. So it's also a real driver for ideas on how we can do better and have a bigger impact as an organization as well. So for us, it's not just so much, let's get that story out there because we know people want to hear it and how much wonderful feedback we've received. We didn't know what to expect when we went into this, and we picked the topic and the title because there's so many podcasts out there that talk about research and you talk to the doctors and the clinicians, but you don't hear just from the people who've been impacted, right?
100%.
So we may have already answered this, but we'll go ahead. Natasha always asks our last question.
Yes. So it's here's our last question, and then there's an official last question. But the last question, Brian, if there was one message you wanted to leave with our listeners, what would that be?
One message. Keep moving. Keep moving. Just keep moving.
I love it.
That is kind of easy to remember and easy to execute. You'll feel better and give you a sense of purpose. Just keep moving.
Keep moving. And Brian, if people in the community wanted to connect with you, is there a way for them to do that?
I don't do social media, so email is fine.
Hey, yeah.
Feel free to reach out to me by email. I'd be glad to be responsive, and any help I can give, I'd be more than glad to do that.
Awesome. Well, we will definitely put that in the show notes. But Brian, thank you so much for sharing your story and your experience and your perspective. Like Brandy said in the beginning, you know, it's not often we get to talk to somebody who is a 20-year survivor, and it's really special to have the time with you today.
Well, let me turn it around and say thank you guys for what you're doing. It's really impactful. And I, as a survivor, I really appreciate what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.